Hello. On this week's program, we look ahead to a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, featuring the works of some talented local artists. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns profiles pianist Yuja Wang. The fast-rising star is the soloist when the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields performs at the Kimmel Center on Wednesday. Susan Lewis visits historic Eastern State Penitentiary, now planning the renovation of a synagogue within its walls. And Jason Pfeiffer looks ahead to this year's Cherry Blossom Festival of Greater Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Center for Emerging Visual Artists has been a hub in Philadelphia for up-and-coming local artists since its founding 25 years ago. The center provides a resource where artists receive help with finding studio space, setting up exhibitions, as well as career development counseling and networking opportunities. In addition, the center holds lectures, open studio tours, and monthly exhibitions. With an initial focus on painters, printmakers, and sculptors, it later expanded to include all varieties of the visual arts. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is now hosting an exhibit that features current or former fellows of the center. But in this crop of contemporary artists, could there be a future great painter, sculptor, or photographer? And if such a talented artist was in our midst, how would we know? These were some of the topics I discussed with Maida Malone, the president and CEO of the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, and Catherine Ware, curator of photographs at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Well, let's first of all get to this central issue of whether or not the Philadelphia Museum of Art should be showing contemporary artists. One argument says that it's a public museum, it's dedicated to superlatives in all of the visual arts. Others would argue that, to paraphrase the American Composers Forum slogan, all art was once contemporary art. Kate.
Absolutely. We're very interested in contemporary art, and especially being in Philadelphia, which has such a rich, rich community of artists. It's something we're really engaged in. But as you say, the museum collects art essentially from the beginning of art making until the present and globally. So that's a lot of competition for contemporary art as well as for regional artists.
Maida, if Picasso or Matisse were living and working in Philadelphia today, would we know about him?
Well, you might well know about them from exhibitions done by the Center for Emerging Visual Artists. And I have to say, I'm really so pleased that if there were a Matisse or a Picasso working with us today, they might well be shown by the Philadelphia Museum of Art in the kind of exhibition that's being shown now, the 25-year retrospective of the work of SIVA artists.
Notably, Kate, this exhibition is taking place in the Director's Gallery at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and I know that Anne Darnicourt has got an interest in what's happening today by the living and the breathing.
She does, absolutely, and many of us do. It's really exciting to be able to get out and visit artist studios, and I know a lot of my colleagues do that, and we see people in the galleries as well. I would say there's such a constellation of other institutions here in town that we're just part of that picture. And so we do rely on some of the organizations such as SIVA to bring people along and bring people to our attention. And then at some point, they may make their way into our building as well.
Maida, there isn't, in the same way that possibly there is in the UK, any sort of constellation of fine art stars. They have Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst and people like that. Why is it the case that the really successful contemporary artists in America are long established? We don't have 20-year-olds or people who are under 30, typically, whose paintings are both attractive to wealthy collectors and to institutional collectors.
It's a very interesting question, one I have to say I haven't really given a lot of thought to. I think, you know, it's just sort of the competitive nature of America, of all the things that we do in America, and it's really a combination of sort of talent and scrappiness and serendipity and opportunity that you have to have as an artist here in the U.S. I think in other countries, there are more institutionalized support systems, I think maybe, and more government support for the arts than we have here in the U.S., which probably gives people a leg up and allows them to develop their careers earlier.
But I'll say something as devil's advocate, which is, what does somebody right out of art school have to say anyway? You know, it is a really interesting phenomenon that you're describing, and some of that is the art machine and the art world machine, and it's about flash and fashion and glitz, and those are all perfectly valid things. But one of the things that we're interested here in here at the Art Museum, too, is people who have vision and the longevity of that vision. So in some ways, we tend to come in more at the mid-career level in which some of these people have proved themselves and do have shown that they have a consistent message.
I think it's a great point because staying power is really important. I mean, you can have an early vision, early inspiration, do some good work, but if you can't kind of, you know, mature and develop and have staying power, then that does say something about sort of the quality of your work as an artist.
But that said, if there were a Jasper Johns out there, and presumably most institutional collectors are not in a position to pay cash dollars for a Jasper Johns these days, but he still has early work that's now has a high value. Is there an economic sense in keeping an eye on who's out there who might have something to say, who in the long term you might be collecting?
Oh, absolutely. And that's certainly something I'm really committed to. I go to a lot of portfolio reviews, such as Photo Fest in Houston, and seeing things here in town in terms of the Print Center and SIVA and other places, bringing people along just to get that idea of getting it on the ground floor, whether or not we immediately collect that person's work. But definitely, I think that's really important. But I think what your comments maybe raised too, Maida, is how do you have that staying power if you're in a society that doesn't support doing that kind of work? That's one of the tough things.
And that's really the purpose of the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, because part of what we're trying to do is to help artists develop the skills that they need to market themselves and sustain themselves in the long run.
And you referred earlier on to this kind of idea of talent and timing and serendipity. Presumably there are people out there with talent. You're helping them a little bit with the serendipity if you can arrange luck. Is it enough?
I don't think so. I don't want to get on my soapbox about the U.S. society and how little, I think, sort of intrinsic support there is for artists. You know, you can walk into so many people's homes who really seem to value important cultural events and cultural institutions, and yet you see, you know, posters on people's walls. There's very little original art that I see in so many of the homes and businesses that I go into. And it's really shocking to me. And I think in Europe, certainly in South America, there is just a culture that really supports artists and artwork and having it in your home. And we just don't, I think, as a culture, support artists as much as we should.
Well, I'll get on my soapbox too, which is to say that I think you're better off being an emerging artist or dead. And it's that huge spectrum of people in between that, to my eye, are really in the tough spot. And that's something that we're interested in trying to rectify a little bit here at the museum. But if you're emerging, you're in school or you're just out of school, or you maybe can, you know, be a new talent or get an award or have a little beginning show, and then there's just sort of this long period in which you've already been discovered, quote unquote. And certainly some of the artists in this show, they're not very well known. But you could say they're mid-career or even beyond, but they're still not very well known. And so, you know, while we may not collect people, we don't collect student work here at the museum for the most part. We don't necessarily collect a lot of really beginning emerging artists, but we are really interested in those who have, you know, reached mid-career and are still struggling for that national and international reputation.
Catherine Ware, the curator of photographs at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Maida Malone, the president and CEO of the Center for Emerging Visual Artists. Emerging to Established, 25 years of the Center for Emerging Visual Artists, opens today at the Director's Gallery on the first floor of the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Curtis Institute of Music student Yuja Wang only had her first legal drink in February, pomegranate tequila, if you will, but she's now on tour with the famous Academy of St. Martin in the Fields as a last-minute replacement for the venerable Murray Pariah. On Wednesday, the tour stops at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia, with Wang playing under the celebrated conductor Sir Neville Mariner. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns caught up with the tour in Boston and reports that everybody is getting along so well, musically and personally, that Sir Neville is talking about fixing Miss Wang up with his eligible grandson.
Yuja Wang has feverish practice hours in unlikely places, such as Boston Symphony Hall, while carpenters are preparing the stage for the night's concert. Her career was already well along before her current tour with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. As long ago as 2002, she had prestigious engagements such as Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 with the Tonhalle Orchestra of Zurich. Last season, she replaced Martha Argerich in what became her Boston Symphony debut. But this current tour is giving her a grand introduction to many U.S. cities. Even Philadelphia, where she lives, hasn't heard her much in concerto repertoire. In this concert, she plays two concertos plus an encore.
For Mozart, you just have to have a perfect piano, and they don't usually have that, especially on a tour.
When Murray Pariah canceled due to a skin infection, the St. Martin in the Fields ensemble was faced with possibly abandoning the tour, and with it, a financial wind shear with long-term impact. Though Neville Mariner founded the orchestra almost a half century ago, he doesn't work much with the Academy these days, but got out of a long-planned commitment in Zagreb. When Wang was hired, on the suggestion of several U.S. presenters, and after she was released from playing Rachmaninoff in Portland, the two hit it off so well at their initial interview, Wang suggested that, in addition to playing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24, she'd replace the previously planned Mendelssohn String Symphony with the same composer's first piano concerto, even though neither of the pieces were in her active repertoire.
So he was like, you know, I really don't like this String Symphony. I was like, do you need help? I really wanted to play two concertos in one concert. I think that's really cool. I mean, Mozart is great, but I just feel like it's not enough. So I was like, I can totally play the concerto, you know? And then within the same fee. So he was like, oh, that's good.
And off they went to Houston, Santa Barbara, Costa Mesa, Chapel Hill. Now conductor Mariner is worried that she'll practice too hard before the concerts.
The problem with Uja is getting her out of it, not getting her into it. And I mean, you can hear her upstairs now. She will not leave it alone. She is never satisfied with her own performance. And from the moment we step on, in fact, the moments before we step onto the stage, she's still got the score in her hand. So she is an intensely dedicated pianist.
Ever since Yuja Wang arrived in North America roughly 6 years ago from her native China, she's learned major works easily, quickly, and well. Her Russian-trained teacher in China drilled into her a rock-solid technique by the time she was 10, allowing her to encompass Liszt's heroic Sonata in B minor in this recital she played earlier this year. What's remarkable is that even in performances of Beethoven at his most philosophical, her playing reflects strong ideas on how the piece should go. While veteran musicians like conductor Charles Dutoit remark that Yuja Wang doesn't seem to know that what she does is difficult, she says that adult musicians sometimes make their work more complicated than it needs to be. But then, she's always been a bit of a contrarian, often doing the opposite of what her teachers say. Due to the practical necessity of coming up with alternatives, she finds that the rejection of other ideas stimulates her own. Among those alternatives, she prefers Mozart's less characteristic minor key pieces and admires pianists who are more about instinct than deliberation, such as Art Tatum. In that spirit, she wrote her own cadenza to the first movement of Mozart's 24th piano concerto.
Yeah, this cadenza is crazy. Well, I wrote it in like 2 hours because I only knew this is happening in a week. I didn't even write it down. I just played around with whatever comfortable in my hand. And then sort of remembered it. I was like, oh, that's good. And actually, I was going to play differently every time, but Sir Neville was like, just make sure you play the trio in the end so I know when to come in. So
Neville Mariner is having a grand time with it all, but he knows not everybody will.
I'm sure there are going to be snide remarks about her cadenza that she wrote herself. Mozart didn't provide one, so she provided one. And it's all her 19th century and 20th century background of pianistic ability has come into this. Mozart would have probably been shattered to have both the musical imagination and the technical facility involved in it.
Like many young musicians, Yuja Wang worries about how much audiences will like her when she's older and less novel. She worries that audiences listen with their eyes more than their ears and respond more to velocity than poetry. But of all the fresh faces that have come out of the Curtis Institute in recent years, few have such a natural, unfussy, rhetorical eloquence. Almost invariably, her playing is as accessible, direct, and personal as conversation, in the language of Mozart, Beethoven, Liszt, and even in the flashier moments of Rimsky-Korsakov.
Philadelphian Choir music critic David Patrick Stearns. Yuja Wang performs Mozart's 24th and Mendelssohn's first piano concertos with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner, at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Wednesday. The program also features Mozart's Paris Symphony and Haydn's London Symphony. According to a recent report by the Pew Public Safety Performance Project, America now has the dubious distinction of incarcerating one out of every 100 adults, imprisoning a larger percentage of its population than any other country in the world. Whether this is a wise use of tax dollars, an appropriate remedy for drug and other nonviolent violations, or results in a safer citizenry is far from clear. While most people try to avoid a prison experience, there's one facility in Philadelphia where they pay to get in. Not surprisingly, its story tells as much about the outside population as those inside. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us inside Philadelphia's most famous prison.
The large iron gates close at Eastern State Penitentiary, a place of contradictions. Its Gothic exterior hides an interior where arched ceilings soar over passageways bathed in natural light from 1,000 skylights. Built as a prison, it had indoor plumbing and central heating even before the White House. Made famous for its philosophy that solitary confinement would lead to redemption, communal activities gradually took over. And while by the early 1920s it had an interdenominational chapel, someone saw fit to build a synagogue, complete with a small back room for the preparing of kosher food.
The Ark was there where the Torah would have gone.
Cindy Wannerman, president of Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site, accompanies us into the 14 by 32 foot room, which in 1924 was built by combining four solitary confinement exercise yards and putting a roof on top. 4 years ago, Wannerman first visited the room, then in ruins, but filled with evidence of its role.
This table over here, which is where the Torah scrolls would be laid down to be read from, and on the door, the two Stars of David.
The doorway is down one of the alleys created by the building's design, which was groundbreaking for the penitentiary's 1829 opening in what had been a cherry orchard on the outskirts of Philadelphia. British-born architect John Haviland's original plan called for a central rotunda from which would radiate seven long, narrow cell blocks. In solitary confinement, away from influences of any other humans, prisoners would have time to reflect, repent, and redeem themselves. Or that was the theory, says Eastern State's program director, Sean Kelly, from inside an 8x12 cell.
It's got an arched ceiling, about a 16-foot barrel-vaulted ceiling, and a very eerie circular skylight. They called it a dead eye, looking down at us. They wanted the light from God to come down across the inmates as they spent time in these tiny little cells, 23 hours a day, plus 2 half-hour breaks outside in their own exercise yards, but never seeing another inmate. They wanted these four stone walls to be the only thing that the prisoner saw during the length of his whole stay at Eastern State.
And what about noise? Did they have to be quiet?
They were so fascinated by silence here, they made the officers wear socks over their shoes as they walked the corridors.
This new kind of penal approach in its state-of-the-art building became famous as the Pennsylvania system, inspiring copies all over the world and drawing to Philadelphia both prison reformers and tourists. In 1858, more than 10,000 came.
If you can imagine looking around us and seeing couples in the bustling skirts of the mid-19th century walking down these corridors, but in silence, while the inmates lived in total isolation on the other side of the doorways.
Isolation, however, was controversial as well as difficult to implement, and over time the policy eroded. Only three of the first seven cell blocks were single-story. Crowding led first to two-story cell blocks, then later to doubling up in cells. In the late 1800s, new cell blocks were added in the spaces between existing ones. In 1913, solitary confinement was officially abandoned, except as punishment. Dining halls and other common spaces were created. By the 1920s, the penitentiary, once intended for 256 inmates, held 1,700. Named a National Historic Landmark in 1965, it stopped housing prisoners in 1971. Then came years of neglect, but not total abandonment. Cats moved in and started having more cats, and eventually there were nearly 40, all fed by the last city caretaker three times a day for 28 years. Eastern State was resurrected as a tourist site in 1994. Targeted areas now continue to be cleaned and open to the public, revealing forgotten chapters of its history. In 2004, Laura Mass was a student in historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania when she was tapped to help uncover, literally, the story of the synagogue.
When I first walked in, more than 50% of the plaster ceiling had fallen onto the floor and then been stepped on and compacted. So there's 5 to 6 inches of debris, plaster, paint, wire lath, wood on the floor.
Mass treated the job like an archaeological excavation.
We took white spray paint and made out a grid, and we took little trowels, and we just sat here, and every day or every couple of days, we attacked a new square.
Among the finds, decorative plaster fragments and sheet music for songs.
Finding those song sheets was pretty exciting because, I mean, it was, you know, it's sort of like frozen in time. The song sheets were still there, like they had just been in here, like sitting around singing Hanukkah songs. It was kind of neat.
The community of Jewish inmates was nurtured by volunteers, among them board president Alfred Fleischer, who led the effort to build the synagogue, and strongman entertainer Joseph Paul, who donated food from his kosher butcher shop and helped inmates find jobs after their release. It is the story of these volunteers that especially resonates today with current president Cindy Wannerman.
These people and other people really cared about the Jewish prisoners and wanted to give them a Jewish life. And we have photographs of holidays that were celebrated here that you can see them all standing together.
Today, Eastern State Penitentiary tells this and other stories through tours, exhibits, and with artwork, like the cat sculptures placed throughout the site in honor of its former feline inhabitants and the man who fed them, or the installation in certain cells, where a peek through a small opening in the door reveals time-lapsed photography showing how sunlight from the skylights moves across the cell. Some people, says Eastern State's program director, Sean Kelly, claim to have found ghosts within these walls.
They see orbs floating around in their photographs, and their batteries die on their equipment. They leave out recording devices and hear voices when they come back to play them back. Some of it really is creepy, and there is something about this building. It's beautiful, but really poignant.
Beautiful, poignant, and a bit eerie. Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site still inspires reflection about the lives of people who lived and worked here, about America's changing attitudes towards crime, and about our individual and collective potential to touch our fellow human beings.
WRTI Susan Lewis. The synagogue at Eastern State Penitentiary is open to the public today and tomorrow before it closes for restoration, which is expected to be completed in time for the October observance of Yom Kippur. Today marks the start of the 6th Cherry Blossom Festival of Greater Philadelphia. The 2 weeks of programming include everything from taiko drumming and a sake festival to an amateur sushi-making contest. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the celebration highlights the city's connections to Japanese culture.
Over the last 10 years, the Japan-America Society of Greater Philadelphia has planted over 1,000 cherry trees in the Fairmount Park area of the city. From this initiative came Philadelphia's Cherry Blossom Festival. A simple celebration in 2003, with only a few hundred people, it has grown exponentially. Last year's Spring Festival brought out an estimated 20,000 visitors. At the forefront of this festival is Kazumi Tuni, executive director of the Japan America Society, an association designed to promote business and cultural ties between Japan and the Philadelphia region. A Philadelphia resident for decades, Tuni grew up in Japan, where the blooming of the ubiquitous cherry trees, called sakura in Japanese, has been celebrated for hundreds of years.
It's impossible to avoid the pink skies at this time. It's full bloom in Tokyo now.
The beauty of the pink flowering tree and the timing of its bloom help explain the ever-growing popularity of the Japanese cherry blossom, according to Paul Meyer, director of the Morris Arboretum of the University of Pennsylvania.
The fact that they bloom so early, they're a great celebration of the end of winter, the beginning of spring. And, you know, when it comes down to it, that's a lot of what the Cherry Blossom Festival is about in Japan. You know, you're getting out of doors after being cooped up all winter long, and it's just very exhilarating to see these blossoms literally explode with just a couple days of warm weather.
Meyer points out that the Japanese cherry trees are not bred for their fruit. In fact, many of the varieties are sterile, hybrids designed to produce large, showy flowers. For years, Japan has been sharing these flowering trees with others. Philadelphia's cherry blossom collection started in 1926 when the Japanese government donated 1,600 flowering trees to the city in honor of the 150th anniversary of American independence. Paul Meyer says the Japanese cherry blossom has a history of use in diplomacy. For instance, Washington, D.C.'s renowned collection includes gifts from the Japanese government in 1912 and 1965.
It's sort of an easy place to start with international exchange, and the cherries are beautiful, and regardless of what culture you're from, you can appreciate the beauty of the cherries.
Another example of this kind of international exchange in Philadelphia is the Japanese House and Garden in West Fairmount Park.
These are the shoji, which are the paper doors, and when they're closed, you get some natural light.
Prudence Haynes is the executive director of the Japanese House, which was built in the 16th century style of a wealthy Japanese home. Nearby, there's a pond and an ornamental garden, complete with Japanese cherry trees. Originally, Japan gave the structure to the Museum of Modern Art in New York for exhibition in 1954 and 55, but subsequently it was donated to the city of Philadelphia and reassembled in 1958 at its current site.
After World War II, there was a period of reconciliation during the 50s between the Japanese government and the American government. And the people of Japan wanted to give a gift of this house to the American people so that Americans could understand Japanese culture a little bit more fully.
Despite such notable, visible symbols of Japanese culture in Philadelphia, it's surprising that the Japanese community in the area is relatively small. Prudence Haynes says there are only about 25,000 Japanese residents in the five-county region. She says Western enthusiasm for Japanese culture, particularly among younger generations, is due in part to popular culture.
Whether it be anime or music or clothing, the fashion industry is very big in Japan. There is a huge fascination among college students and among young people with things that are Japanese and things that are Asian.
According to the Japan America Society's Kazumi Tuni, attitudes and knowledge about Japanese culture have changed significantly since she came to Philadelphia as a student 25 years ago.
My generation, 50s, 60s, had entirely different perception about Japan. You know, we used to be enemies. We didn't like each other for a long time. And Japan was poor, now second largest economy. And U.S.-Japan is almost inseparable in many ways.
The Japan America Society reports that the cherry tree flowers in Philadelphia are blooming on schedule this year, just in time for the centerpiece of the Philadelphia Festival on April 13th, Sakura Sunday, which will feature an array of Japanese music, arts, and food under the canopy of the flowering trees. Though the pink and white cherry trees bloom for only about 2 weeks, the brief emergence of the striking blossoms in Philadelphia is a reminder of international friendship, greater cultural understanding, and the beginning of another spring.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Subaru Cherry Blossom Festival of Greater Philadelphia runs through April 19th at various locations throughout the city, including Fairmount Park's Horticultural Center, the Japanese House and Garden, and the Morris Arboretum. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Zavit Schlank and myself, but thanks also this week to Elizabeth Flynn, Betsy Parkins, Genevieve Petrubis, and Sam Melissa. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.